I'm delighted to be interviewing Professor Mike Maguire today in connection with him achieving the British Society of Criminology Outstanding Achievement Award. I've known Mike for over 25 years now, when I first started as a master's student in Cardiff University. I'm going to start by asking Mike, and that was over 25 years ago, but obviously Mike's career spans even longer than that, and I'm going to ask Mike by starting with, how did you get into criminology?
Well, thank you very much, Fiona. It's a great pleasure to be interviewed by an old PhD student of mine who's now a very successful professor, which ages me a bit. But anyway, it was very, very different in those days. I started in the early 70s, really. There were no undergraduate criminology degrees, just a few modules in law or psychology courses. And there was pretty well only Cambridge that ran a master's, although I think Cardiff was one of the next quite early on in the 70s. So nearly everybody came from other disciplines. And I actually did modern languages, French and German, at Oxford. And after that, I did a postgraduate degree in social anthropology. So what happened was, when I was doing the social anthropology, I got a part-time job on the side with a very small criminology group in Oxford University called, I can't remember what it was called, Centre for Criminological Research or something like that, under Nigel Walker. And I worked with Sarah McCabe and Roy Carhill on an analysis of characteristics of prisoners in Oxford Prison. And this was in the very early days of computers. And those were the days when you had to punch holes in cards and then walk them around to the computer center and hand them over and wait all night for the results. And if you come back, say you made one small mistake, you didn't get any results, so you had to wait another day. So I learned a lot about computing, very hands-on from that. What then happened was, towards the end of my work in social anthropology, there was a job advertised in Salford University with Douglas Webster, who was the author of Social Consequences of Conviction with John Martin, a very well-received book in those days, as a research assistant on a study of criminal networks, looking for social anthropologists and ethnographic field workers with some knowledge of crime and justice. And I think I was probably the only person in the country who had those two subjects together, both of which were quite rare. So I got the job. And I worked on this project for 4 years. It entailed looking at the lives of people in three medium-sized towns in England and Scotland. And these were people who saw themselves as living off crime, sort of criminal subcultures. They regard themselves as offenders, as criminals. And the study was really about how they spent their time, whether they spent a lot of it socializing with other offenders or had ordinary lives with occasional forays into crime and so on. And it entailed a lot of hanging around with them in pubs and cafes, talking to them and so on. You probably wouldn't get through ethics committees and risk assessments these days with that sort of research, but it was quite common in those days. Not necessarily the offenders, but all kinds of ethnography, and I did that, and I really learned a lot about interviewing. It wasn't really interviewing; it was hanging around, but it entailed some interviews, and about criminological research generally. I think I learnt a lot from Douglas Webster, who was a brilliant ethnographer. He knew lots of offenders, and they really liked him, called him the prof, and he always wore very dapper suits and a bow tie. And he taught me that the thing to be is yourself when you're interviewing or doing ethnography or anything like that. So, and also the real pleasure, which I've always had all my life in research, of being able to move seamlessly between very different sets of people who quite often wouldn't talk to each other in a natural way. So you could spend a morning with a very senior manager, the afternoon with people working on the front line, and then the evening with some offenders. And on each case, you'd be overdressed or underdressed, but so you couldn't pretend you were anything what you were. And I was always very honest about what I was doing, why I was doing it, etc. And I found that once you show an interest in people and they see they check you out, they see you're harmless, they will tell you anything. They soon open up. So it's rather like being a journalist, which is actually the other career I had in mind in those days. And also, I used to like the Chicago School very much, which a lot of whom were journalists, of course. Anyhow, to cut a long story short, out of that, the only major thing that came out of that was a paper that we wrote for one of the early criminology conferences. And I think that sort of got me on the road to thinking seriously about a career in criminology. And that was based around a cartoon, a Peanuts cartoon with Lucy and Linus. And Lucy says, "See these fingers? Individually, they're nothing. But when they're put together, they form a weapon fearsome to behold." And Linus looks at his fingers and he says, "Why can't you guys get organized like that?" And that was the title of the paper, "Why Can't You Guys Get Organized Like That?" which was very much what came out of that early study. And a lot of people who see themselves as regular offenders and professionals living from crime are actually have a concept of being of living like that, but they can't get organized to do it. They make all kind of mistakes and so on. So we use that as a sort of metaphor. Anyhow, that's basically how I got into criminology. But after that, for a year after that, there was nowhere else to go. I didn't see myself as having a career in criminology at all. In fact, I did things like I helped to dig a swimming pool, and I tried to get a job on a chess magazine because I liked chess and things like that. So I was looking at all kinds of other avenues. However, then I was lucky and I got another job, which I can talk about later if you like. But that's how I got into criminology in the first place.
Well, that is brilliant, Mike. There's some real little gems there. I mean, I've known you a long time and I'm learning new things about you already, which is really brilliant. So I know that you started off as an ethnographer, and I'm sure that me being supervised by you may have influenced me, because I absolutely love ethnography as well, and I think it's one of the most rewarding ways of doing research. But I know that you've actually gone on, of course, to use all sorts of different research methods throughout your career for many different sorts of projects, and I just wondered if you could talk us a little bit through what kind of research methods you've used and why, and why you think different methods are important.
First of all, I would say on I certainly moved away from ethnography with offenders in that sense, although I've always tried to keep talking to offenders much more these days, well, almost exclusively these days through formal interviews in custody or in probation offices, etc. So that sort of hanging out in the streets and the pubs is sort of well behind me now. But I think what happened was that the next job I got was as a research officer in Oxford University with Roger Hood, who was running the Oxford Centre for Criminology, and to undertake a project on burglary. And that was funded by the Home Office, which was quite interesting because in those days, the Home Office research unit was very independent of the rest of government, and whoever was in charge of the unit could basically decide what kind of research they wanted, as opposed to being told what to research by the policy units. And they wanted just a study of burglary. They didn't sort of define it very carefully. They gave us 3 years worth of money. Roger Hood persuaded them to give them money and to say, just go off and have a look at burglary. We don't know much about who does it, what happens, what we do about it, etc. And basically come back in 3 years. And I ran that project, and that's when I met Trevor Bennett, who joined me on the project. And we together put together this study of burglary, I'll talk about methods in a minute, but I'm just trying to sort of get the sense. This was funded by a government department, but with a lot of freedom about what we did. And I then moved, as you say, from ethnography towards more formal types of methods, particularly interviews. I mean, that was very much an interview-based study. We interviewed 50 convicted burglars, some of them outside prison, but quite a lot of them in prison. And above all, what really had an influence on the rest of my career, or certainly in the early years of it, was we did a study of, we interviewed 322 victims, it's burned into my memory, between us. And that was going round to victims' houses. We got the addresses from the police of people who'd been burgled, and wrote to them and said, would you talk about it? And that really opened my eyes to the impact that crime, and particularly burglary, had upon the victims. And we wrote a book, it was called Burglary in a Dwelling.
Jesus, Burglary.
Burglary in a Dwelling was the book. And that had chapters on the offenders, which was my main interest because I'd been doing that before, and on the policing of it, on the patterns of it. But we had a chapter on victims, and everybody who read it in those days said, really interesting book, thank you very much. And the only chapter they were interested in was the victims one. We also published a separate article in the British Journal of Criminology on that. And for the rest of the 80s, I was myself, along with Joanna Shapland, who also worked in the centre, and she was interested in victims of violence particularly, we became the kind of the gurus of victim studies in England and Wales, and the centre became known as victim studies. And those were the days, of course, the early days of the British Crime Survey. In fact, I wrote some of the questions in one of the early crime surveys on burglary victims. I did a big study with Claire Corbett on victim support schemes, interviewed a lot of people on those schemes who are running them. And we had quite a lot of influence in that study did, which led to quite a lot of money being invested by the government in victim support and so on. So that was very much the 80s for me, was victim studies. And you talk about methods. Yeah, I think interviewing was very much the main method. But of those studies, what I would say about methodology more generally is that I'm very much an eclectic person who likes doing all kinds of methods together, if you like. I like the term triangulation. I like to hit any study from as many angles as possible, different perspectives on it. That's why I like this idea of interviewing different groups and putting their perspectives together. And more generally, as I was brought up on social anthropology and social anthropological methods, I suppose I would be mainly doing what sociologists tend to call grounded theory. In social anthropology, you just basically go into a society with as few preconceived ideas as possible. Obviously, you have some sort of theoretical baggage with you, and you have some prejudices with you and preconceived ideas. But the idea is that you're as flexible as possible, and you try to let people tell you what they think, listening to as many different voices as possible. And you hit the same question from a lot of perspectives. So this is a mixed methods, and I like both quantitative and qualitative methods. I wouldn't say I was an expert on either, but I can hold my own in quantitative until I speak to someone like my son, who's got a PhD in mathematics, and it makes me feel very, very inadequate. But at the same time, I think simply quantitative methods do not get at the reality of things. So you need to put them in context and to explain things. And I think you need qualitative stuff with it, and vice versa. Just a few qualitative interviews tells you something in depth, but it doesn't give you a broad feeling of how prevalent everything is. The two are artificially separated. And I think the last thing to say is, when I approach a study, I don't think I'm going to use X methods at the beginning. I think, what are the research questions I want to answer, and what are the best methods I can find, and what is feasible to answer them? And then and sort of you start with the questions, not with the method. So I think that's my thinking on methodology.
Brilliant. Thank you, Mike. Well, I think that leads into a question I wanted to ask you about how the discipline has changed. And you've touched on this already by talking about how the Home Office, you know, kind of gave you 3 years to go and find out about burglary, which would just be unheard of these days.
Because absolutely.
It's now much more very fast paced. It's a lot of control sometimes over the methodology, which is actually put me off doing research for Home Office and other government bodies, you know, over the years, really, because you haven't got that freedom that as academics like to have. So what other things would you say have changed about the discipline, whether it's, for the good or the bad, really?
Well, first of all, to pick up what you just said about the narrowing and the tightening of specs, if you like, specifications for particular bits of research, that was partly one of the main reasons I left Oxford in the end. I left Oxford to go to Cardiff as a lecturer, taking a huge salary cut, I might add, to go back to being a probationer lecturer. Because it was largely because, or as you say, we had that freedom early on, but in the 80s, everything tightened up much more in funding, particularly government funding, Home Office and other departments. They got much more embedded into policy divisions who set the agenda, and it was usually a very short term agenda. Quite often you'd be asked to do a piece of research, or you'd bid to do it on something, you'd provide it, and they say, but thank you very much, but we've settled that question a long time ago, we're not interested anymore. So it was so short term, it was shorter periods to do it in. As you say, there were more controls about what you could publish, although I think that was exaggerated. I think the problem was that people used to self-censor and not make major criticisms, which probably should have been made, not because the Home Office said you can't publish that, but because people thought that's what might happen. So there was all those things together, and I think the job in places that were very highly reliant on government funding, which Oxford was in those days, the problem was places like that became subject to criticism, quite correct criticism, becoming what the sociologists often referred to as administrative criminology. In other words, you were sort of having the agenda set for you by government, and you were not really thinking outside the box yourself. It was a very narrow sort of way of working. That was a gradual process. But by about 1990, I felt that was what life was becoming. And also, I was getting older, and the life of a contract researcher is pretty precarious and very stressful, because you would have, say, a 6-month study going on now. You'd have to be doing that. You'd have to be writing up the one you did last time, because you had to keep publishing, you felt, if you wanted some sort of career. And also you'd be looking forward to the next one, so you'd be bidding for more money for the next time. And just it was just like juggling 7 days a week. So anyway, I was very lucky that Mike Levy, who was the main criminologist in Cardiff University, asked me to apply for a lectureship there. And I thought, well, I'm not really a teacher, though I did some teaching. I'm a researcher through and through. However, I'll give it a go, if I get the job. And so I gave myself 3 years. I said, if I don't like it, I'll try and get back into research. But I really enjoyed being at Cardiff, the freedom of researching what you wanted, what you wanted to look at. You could bid for research from all kinds of possible funders, or even do research without any funding. And you also had the teaching, which kind of allowed you to use your research in teaching. So I never looked back really from that. I don't think I would go back to a specialist research centre. I won't. At my age, I won't go back to anything. But I wouldn't have gone back to Oxford. Although permanent jobs did come up in Oxford, but I didn't want to go back. I decided to stay in Cardiff, and I really enjoyed it. And then, of course, later I retired from Cardiff early and have worked part time in University of South Wales. Ever since, for 15 or so years, and I've really enjoyed that as well. So I like the mixture of teaching and research, although research is still my main interest. Anyway, sorry, I've completely rambled off the point. What was your question? How has discipline changed? Right.
You have answered that, and you've also, it's very interesting that you've said that you didn't see yourself as a teacher or a lecturer, because of course, to me, you're the best lecturer that I've ever had, and you absolutely inspired me to continue along the path of being a criminologist. And we all used to say, when we used to be waiting outside Park Place for you to turn up with your massive bundle of books in your arms, you know, you were exactly what a proper professor was like. You looked like you were completely disorganized, and then we'd all be captivated in the classroom. It was just brilliant.
Usually unprepared and rambling. Can I just finish? Sorry, yes, I'll try and do it quickly. How the discipline has changed in other ways. Well, obviously, more people are doing it. And so there's a much greater range of skills and backgrounds and knowledge. The discipline itself has expanded enormously. It's interesting to remember, I think the first degree in criminology was about 1993 or 4, wasn't it? I can't remember where, I think it was Teesside. But what you really notice is that subjects that were never talked about in my early days, things like green criminology and state criminology, state crime and so on, organized crime. Mike Levy's always been interested in that, but very few other people were. And of course, cyber crime, etc. So it's become a different subject, as well as different and more people doing it. I think there's also, because of that partly, there's less infighting in the subject. When I started in the 70s, there was real enmity between the sort of deviancy theorists and the radical criminologists on one side, and what they designated as traditional criminologists or later administrative criminologists on the other. And the traditional criminologists were still very much people who came from psychology or psychiatry and took a very empiricist view of offenders. They were a group of very special people who had to find out what was wrong with them, what would correct them, and so on. So it's sort of correctional. The word correction was very much the American take on that. So I think that, but now that sort of enmity, that split has gone. And there are still schools of criminologists, and people don't like some approaches, but they don't fight over it. There's if you go to a conference, you don't have to go to the ones on the type of criminology you don't like, and you don't spend your time criticizing the other schools. You know, the 80s was too, as well, between left realists and right realists, or right left idealists and right realists and left realists, etc. There were these little groups who spent a lot of their time slagging each other off, basically. But now I think it's much more of a broad church. I think also the subject has become accepted more by other subjects as a real subject. For a long time, criminology was, and I think there's still some of this around, it was largely based in schools of sociology or schools of law. And both of those groups used to look down quite often on the criminologists, as it wasn't a real subject like law or like sociology. But I think it's got more respect now, and it's much more theoretically driven than it was. It's true that it's still quite an empirical and slightly empiricist subject, but there are some very, very good theorists in criminology as well. So I think it's become a much more rounded and and mature subject, if you like. As I said before, the methodology has developed a lot, where there's a lot more use of online research. The quantitative research is now very good. There used to be very few quantitative criminologists, or people like Leslie Wilkins were good statisticians, but most were amateurs like me or worse than me at quantitative work. And methods is taught much more in schools. You can't do a PhD or even a master's these days without doing quite a lot of methods. So I think that's improved an awful lot from sort of the amateur days when I started. But on the other hand, the thing that I think has gone downhill is what I started with, ethnography. That actually, if you think back to great ethnographers, there were people like Neil Shover in America, and on the policing side, Simon Holdaway, sort of undercover work in a police station. And Patrick, wasn't it, James, a Glasgow gang observed. There are very few books like that around now, real classics of genuine ethnography. And I think that's a pity as well. It may come back, but it's largely because of quite legitimate safety concerns and ethical concerns as well. But I think those are ways in which it's changed. I think it's much better to split now because it's much more interesting and varied and exciting. Anyway, that's my answer on how criminology has changed. Another ramble, sorry.
So I wanted to ask you now, Mike, about the highlights, the real highlights of your career. You know, just what you pick out, some of the things that in particular you look back on fondly. Perhaps leading into kind of the impacts of your work, and I know there's been lots and lots of them, but not everybody will know about all of those.
Yeah, well, highlights are difficult. I think the things I remember, if you ask me to say what things really stand out in your mind as really enjoyable times and things I'm glad I got involved in, I think number one would be probably the Oxford Handbook of Criminology, which we did five, Robert Reiner and Rob Morgan and myself did five editions of, and now as we've handed over to a younger and more diverse group who are doing a very good job. We started that mid-90s, early 90s. I think Rod and I got together. We were saying that we don't like textbooks in criminology. There isn't nothing that we really think is really gets underneath the skin of the discipline to give to the growing numbers of students who are appearing in criminology. And we had the idea of asking the best people we could go for, you know, so who are the really good criminologists, mainly in Britain, and ask each of them, give them 20,000 words, and do a sort of state of the art review of where they think that topic, their topic is, that was a fairly simple format, but. It worked magically the first time. I think the first edition was tremendous. It was difficult to live up to afterwards. And so I was really pleased to have that. Virtually everybody said yes to it. And we didn't try to editorialize. We just said, do it your way. So there was no one theme to the book, but I quite like that variety. You've got a real sense of what these are the key movers and shakers in this discipline. What are they thinking about now? So I was quite proud of that and really enjoyed doing it. What's interesting is now is that handbooks are to a penny. I think we did one of the first things called a handbook of something. Now you could probably find about 40 of them in different subjects. And the irony of it is, of course, they're not handbooks. They're huge doorstoppers. They're nothing, you know, nothing you could carry in your hand or your pocket.
Handbook of Criminology certainly stands out amongst them all, though, in criminology.
I think it will last. I think it's established itself very well. I think it's better than the American Handbook of Criminology as well. Not due to us, it was due to the quality of the people we got involved. So that really stands out. Very quickly, two other things. One, I always remember the 1993 conference, British Criminology Conference, which was held in Cardiff, which we helped to organise. And the real highlight of that was getting Taylor, Walton and Young back together. And to me, it was like sort of a Pink Floyd revival, or getting, you know, getting the Beatles back together or something like that. They were the real stars of the 70s with their book, The New Criminology, which was very influential. And we had the three of them together on a platform for about the first time in, nearly 20 years, yeah, probably 15 years. That was a real highlight. And I think, you know, because you've been flattering me, I'll flatter you. I think the other highlight of my career has been the very, very good PhD students I've had, several of whom are now leading criminologists and professors like yourself. Not all of them, but just in University of South Wales, yourself and Cheryl Allsop as well, a more recent PhD student of mine. And to be fair, I think the one that really stands out for me is Andy Aitchison, who is a lecturer. I think he's probably a reader now in Edinburgh University. He was absolutely brilliant. He learnt Serbo-Croat for his thesis. That sort of shows you what sort of mind he has. It was very difficult. We were trying to push. I supervised him along with Trevor Jones, and he was so good that we very often get a draft from him, and we could hardly find anything to comment on. It was so good. He got a lectureship in a top university about a year before he finished his PhD. Just the interview, they were just blown away by him. So he's a real highlight for me, as of course you are, and Cheryl, and many, many others.
Didn't you used to call him Carry On? Didn't you have a little nickname?
Well, yeah, I wasn't going to say that, but we did. That, it was our nickname for him, Carry On Aitchison, because we used to read one of his chapters and had very little to criticise. So we used to think of the supervision say, "Very good, carry on," and that was about it. But don't tell him that, because it'll make his head get too big.
Oh, he's going to hear all about it now. So we've talked about some of the highlights. Are there any things that you look back on in horror, events that you wished hadn't happened, things that you erased from your mind? Because it's always good to hear about some of the
things that sort of shivers up your spine and you wake up in the middle of the night sweating. Yeah, I've got a few of those. I think the one that really stands out to me was I went to a conference, a sort of Euro conference in the Netherlands many years ago, and for some reason it was on policing, and for some reason I was selected to kind of sum up the conference at the end with the full, you know, 200-300 delegates all there on the last morning. And I was supposed to do sort of 10-15 minutes summing up of what had come out of the conference. And what I hadn't realised is the conference was not really about policing, as I was doing quite a few policing studies in those days, in the 90s, as we understood it, policing studies in criminology. It was largely people who were experts on European law. And I would reckon I understood about 20 to 25% of the sessions I went to in the conference. And the idea of me summing up this conference was really horrific. And I think it's the closest I've come. I had to, overnight, I was trying to write this sort of 10 minutes summary for the next day. And I was surrounded by bits of crumbled up papers and had to keep starting again. And in the end, I thought, right, I'm going to go and get the train, get the Eurostar back and leave a message saying I've been taken ill. And I very, very nearly went, but in the end, I faced up to it, and I went and stood there, and I talked about some of the 20% that I had some idea what they'd been talking about. So it's a kind of lesson there: don't take on something you don't know anything about. What else? Yeah, the thing that I nearly made myself ill was another guise, where I've been involved with quite a few sort of policy advisory groups and committees and things like that. And in the early days of one of them, this was a Home Office group. We actually, this group started up, and it had a 9-day meeting. It had a hell of a lot of business to cover.
Wow.
We started on a weekend. We did a whole weekend, 5 days, and the next weekend, with meetings morning and afternoon, almost every day. Well, every day, but plus periods where we had off to read and so on. And I think we nearly all went mad during that week. If anyone ever asks you to be on a 9-day meeting, don't do it, even though it was in a very nice place. But we did get a lot achieved and we got to know each other, but it's still scarred on my brain.
I wanted to ask you now, Mike, about the impact of your work. We've touched on bits of it, but of course, you know, one of the big changes in criminology and lots of other disciplines is the REF. And more recently, the REF has taken into account the impact of research, which it didn't do to begin with, really. It was much more about just the publications and the quality of publications. So, you know, slowly that's being kind of recognised more. But in fact, you know, lots of your research way before that was having important impacts. And, you know, you've talked about the victims of crime earlier and how, you know, when you started interviewing the victims, you really, you know, felt, you know, began to reflect upon the impact of that particular offence.
Yeah.
But I know you've been doing lots of research now about the impacts of imprisonment on offenders and their families and all sorts of other things. So just tell us a little bit about some of the impacts of your work.
Well, it's always difficult to judge your own impact on something. I think, the victims, I think we did have, it wasn't just me, it was Claire Corbett and it was Joanna Shapland and others who worked in the Oxford Centre. Sandra Walkload had a big influence a bit later, etc. But I think we did play a part in bringing victims and victim support to attention. And actually, more concretely, that book we wrote, because it was called The Effects of Crime in the Work of Victim Support Schemes, the one I did with Claire Corbett, that book, we were ordered to rush it out quickly to support decisions. And remember, this was a fairly cost-cutting conservative government in the 80s. Because they were considering funding victim support in a big way nationally. And I think our book had an influence on that. And they were quite keen for the evidence in that book to be out in the public domain, which was part of the justification for that funding. So I think that was a real impact. More recently, I think the Oxford Handbooks had an impact on academia to some extent. I think the other one you mentioned is probably the other one. It is more recent, and there's no very strong impact yet. But we did a big study of the Invisible Walls project. It was a big, you know, 4.5-year study in a lot of depth about an enormous project funded by the big lottery in Park HM Prison Park in Bridgend in Wales, which has done very groundbreaking work in contact between prisoners and their children and families, which entails through the gate mentoring, working with the family outside and the offenders inside at the same time, lots of extra contact, fathers being able to do homework with their children in the evenings, fathers in prison in a special wing, etc. And also hugely changing the visiting facilities. And a lot of that is now being copied, not just in Britain, but overseas. It's only the early days. And it's been taken up by the Farmer Review. Lord Farmer did a report last year, and that's having an impact on prisons gradually. COVID hasn't helped, obviously. So I think I'm hoping that will be quite a major impact over the longer term. So I think those are the main things. Otherwise, I'm getting quite a lot involved in actual advice and committees, as I said, and so you don't know, you know, you're only one individual on an advisory committee or something like that, but you do put your penny worth in, and you have sort of small impacts. Influencing policy is a very, very difficult and not exact science, so you can spend an awful lot of time pushing away at something and nothing happens at all, And another thing, you make a casual remark. I remember Rod Morgan saying when he was, what was he in those days? I think he was head of the Youth Justice Board, wasn't he? And he had a brief conversation with one minister for about half an hour, and they created a new policy out of that half-hour discussion. So it's very, very difficult to predict. What you say has to hit at the right time, and otherwise it will just have no reception. A really good example of that is Shad Maruna, but he was plugging away at what's now become known as desistance theories and desistance perspectives for several years, and nobody listening at all. And suddenly it became flavour of the month within a year. And he just happened to hit the right moment.
There's definitely certain tipping point moments, isn't there, where things are, where there's a receptive audience to an idea.
Exactly. It's a sort of window of opportunity, isn't it? And they're difficult to predict.
Yeah. Of course, you were also on the Pro Board for a long time, Mike. So actually, you also had a lot of impact on whether people were released from prison.
Well, not for a long time. I mean, I was only for 3 years. I think the parole, I don't know if it's still the case, but the parole board had a certain number of professions had to be on the parole board, one of which was criminologists, and I did my time. But that was back in the late 80s, early 90s. Nowadays, I've recently started just one of a group of people who advise the parole board on what research is needed about parole and so on, and particularly about people such as IPP prisoners and so on, you know, recommending what research needs to be done. But that's a minor thing. I'm involved in that's one of the things I've had a small part in. I've had a bigger part what's called the Correctional Services Accreditation and Advice Panel, CSAP. I've been on that some time, and that's really, it kind of accredits and advises about rehabilitative projects for in prisons and probation. I've learned a lot from being on that, because there are a lot of psychologists on that, so I've learned more about psychology than I knew in the past. But I think criminologists play a useful part on it too. So it's a sort of advisor, you know. In Wales, I'm on the Integrated Offender Management Board, which is about partnership. I'm very interested in partnership working between, not just between criminal justice agencies, but also other important agencies such as housing, health, employment, and so on. Getting them to work together, particularly with offenders when they come out of prison. It's one of my current interests in resettlement of offenders. And IOM could be a good vehicle, in Integrated Offender Management, where it isn't just probation officers working with offenders, it's a whole group of those other professions. So, I play a small part in those sort of things. And I think, you know, looking back on my career, a very, very different sort of motivation for doing criminology. I think when I started, I did it mainly out of curiosity. I was interested in other people's lives and just watching, you know, trying to learn how they thought, how they behaved, why, and so on. But I think over the years, it's old age probably, you begin to move towards, you know, I do want to have some sort of impact, realizing it's minor, random, etc. But to have some sort of influence over what can be a very cruel system, criminal justice. People can be badly treated, whether they're victims, offenders, or even staff working in agencies, and, you know, try to put a bit more humanity into it. But I don't kid myself that I have a major influence, but I just think I'm one of many who try to, you know, do a little bit.
I think you're being very modest, Mike, but anyway, what I wanted to ask you next was, who or what inspires you?
Ooh, what, in criminology? Just mentioning some of the things I've done already, it depends what you mean by inspired. In the early days, I was very much inspired by people like Neil Shover and good ethnographers. I really enjoyed their work. These days, when I read other work, I always read anything that David Garland writes, but that's for a completely different reason. And I think that's very important. I think he's one of the best writers. I'm very keen on very good writers who's got what he's good at is expressing complex ideas in a very simple way. And I think that's a good lesson for anybody who wants to be a criminologist or an academic generally. What I don't like is sort of people who overuse jargon and flowery language, and in a way, quite often they're dressing up their lack of clear thought and slight confusion themselves. That's not true of all of them. There are some very, very good flowery writers, but I enjoy people like Garland particularly. Richard Sparks is another like that as well. So I admire people who are good writers. The other ones I think I'm inspired by people, and I've been trying to do this more myself lately, is I was for too many years wearing blinkers about what criminology is. I was very much a mainstream criminologist, if you like. But I'm more and more trying to read and learn about subjects outside that, which have some bearing on criminology. Particularly with recent interest in resettlement, I've learnt a lot more about housing, about mental health, about employment, and about families, as you mentioned. And there's a whole literature in those subjects that I knew nothing about, but now I've read a lot more and have a better understanding of. And so I like people who bring knowledge of other topics to other subjects that have other expertises to criminology. Ken Pease is a good example of that. He's got a very very strange brain. He anything he writes, he'll suddenly be off into another subject and give you a real insight onto criminological topics through his knowledge of other scientific and other topics. So people like that, I think, inspire me. I've been inspired by. I love PhD supervision. I said earlier, I'm not predominantly a teacher, but what I really enjoy about teaching is PhDs and masters, the dissertation supervision as well. And you can learn a hell of a lot from a good PhD student. You in a way, you learn almost as much as they do as they do it. But they become the tutor and you the learner. But of course, you can bring more general things back to help them.
Well, Mike, before I ask you the last question, I just wanted to kind of, you've said so many things that I think are such important messages. I was really struck by what you said early on when we were, you were talking about your early experiences as an ethnographer, about being real, being honest about what you're doing and why, being flexible and trying to capture multiple voices through different sorts of methods. And also, yeah, really interested in what you've just said about clear writers, because you're right, nothing should be so complicated that it can't be well written, but actually it's such an art to write well. And you certainly have always inspired me with your style of writing. But I wanted to finish now with asking you something a bit more personal, which is just about kind of what do you do in your spare time? So outside of criminology, and I know we've had a really strange past few months, obviously, so normal hobbies might be a bit different to what you might normally do. But tell us a bit about what you do in your spare time.
During my career, though I don't do it anymore, I always played cricket. I was obsessed with cricket when I was a student. I sometimes played 5, 6, 7 days a week of cricket because there were so many matches going on. I belonged to lots of midweek clubs as well as weekend ones. But funny enough, I carried on playing cricket, including league cricket, although second 11. Until about 3 or 4 years ago, when I really had to give it up. But although I couldn't, I ended up fielding in the slips and only running singles instead of twos. But I've always enjoyed cricket, and I still watch it a lot. Chess I've mentioned as well. I still play chess, although obviously COVID has put pay to that. You can't touch the pieces and sit right opposite somebody, but you can play that online. So chess has been a lifelong interest, and we just won division something or other 3-4 last year, which was gave me a lot of pleasure. More recently, in COVID lockdown, I've been, for the last 4 years, but particularly this year, I've been focusing on learning Welsh. I started off in languages, and I really enjoy languages for their own sake. But I thought I really must learn Welsh properly. And I've done an awful lot of online classes on Welsh, and I really, really enjoy it. And I should say it's probably the most, well, not probably, it's definitely the most difficult language I've ever come across. And I'll never be able to speak it fluently like other people in the classes. But I love being a nerd. I love the grammar because it is so complicated. I suppose it's a bit like chess, and I treat it a bit like that. I'm not a fluent speaker, but I can write it quite well, and I can work out the grammar. And the other thing I've been doing in COVID is spending hours listening. While I'm doing something else, to old bands. I've absolutely rediscovered people like Dire Straits. I've always loved Pink Floyd, but I've listened to some of their old concerts over and over again. I've always liked Bob Dylan. I've liked Neil Young, people like that. And I'm sort of rediscovering an early love of good, really good rock bands or really good singers like that, especially ones who've lasted all these years. So those have been my main hobbies, I suppose.
And walking, you and Jay, every day, almost every day?
Yeah, we walk up the mountain. She makes me walk about 3 miles every day, and a lot of it uphill as well. So in a funny way, I'm probably fitter than I've been for some years because of this. I've certainly got big calves as a result. And really got to know the countryside around where we live. Surprising how many places you discover that you didn't know existed within 2 or 3 miles of your home. And that applies to the towns as well as the mountain, because we, although we're in a village, the village is quite close to quite a lot of housing.
Yeah, it's amazing how many new paths have been formed since COVID in all sorts of places that have been kind of newly trodden paths that people have created up the various mountains that luckily surround us where we live.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, you live sort of in a town, but on the outskirts, so you've got both, haven't you?
Just behind us, but not one we normally would go up. It's been visited quite a lot lately. Is there anything else, Mike, that you wanted to say before we wrap up this podcast?
I thought you might ask me about sort of. That's what old people get asked, the sort of advice to young people starting out a career in criminology or something like that.
Shall I ask that?
You can ask that if you like. I mean, I think I've mentioned quite a few things I would say on that. One is about writing, polish your writing skills, learn about blinking apostrophes. It drives me mad how many people can't do apostrophes. It seems like a tiny thing, but to nerds like myself, it's horrible to see apostrophes being misused, however's in the middle of sentences, without
semicolons.
I don't mind semicolons too much, because there's different ideas on, you know, what's the difference between a semicolon or a full stop. But it's sort your grammar out, but also think about organizing your work in a very logical way. Don't have a subheading and then start writing about something completely different under the subheading. It's and sort of, you know, students are always taught to plan their essays. Well, if you're writing a book or an article for a journal, you need to plan it very carefully, decide in advance what your argument is going to be, and then stick to it in a fairly logical sort of logic, and it's clarity of writing, and it's good grammar. So I think writing skills, they're almost half the battle, because if you can write well, it shows your thinking clearly as well. The sort of clear writing goes with clear thinking. Another one I would emphasize that I already have about thinking outside the subject as well, and see if you can bring in other knowledge about other things into it, so, and to be flexible and so on.
One of the things that always strikes me is that, you know, when I was an undergraduate student, if the library didn't have the book or the article, then you had to complete an interlibrary loan, which still exists today. But it was quite a drawn out process. It involved filling out lots of bits of cards. And when you got that article, if it was an article, you got to keep it. And if it was a book, you know, you kind of had it on loan for quite some time. And it was like gold dust. You were so pleased to have hold of it that you really, really read it. And I noticed today that students, I almost feel that they're kind of bombarded with the ability to get information quite quickly, that they don't always use it perhaps to the best of their ability in ways that they could, because they're not so precious about it and not so grateful to have received it.
It depends if you're talking about students or young lecturers and things, but with students, I think the problem is that they're so geared to one specific piece of assessment that they sort of think they don't need to know anything else, so just focus on that. They even go to just one or two lectures on the topic they're going to write about. And I think that the ability to read wide and read for its own sake, for interest in the subject or and so on. I know it's very difficult with the exams. I think it's so important. But I think that applies to lecturers as well. You know, don't think I'm an expert on X and I'm only going to read about that. If an opportunity comes along to get involved in a different subject, do so. I mean, I started on ethnography. I moved to victims. When I moved to Cardiff, I got interested in policing for 10 years. And then I've been interested in sort of rehabilitation, resettlement, work with offenders and so on. So although my career looks like a sort of jack of all trades, a bit of everything, in fact, there is a sort of phases to it in which I was doing mainly work on a particular topic. And by the end of that phase, I found a new interest. I applied some of the previous knowledge to it, but sort of moved into a new, it sort of refreshes you, if you like. So again, I think, you know, Mike Levy is a good example. He for the first 20 years of his career, he pretty well only looked at white collar crime. But since that, he's expanded that, and he's used his knowledge in white collar crime to move into other areas such as organized crime of all kinds, and of course and terrorism and financial crime and so on. So he's sort of updated. He's built on his previous knowledge. He's expanded, and I think too many people sort of say, "Oh, I do X," and they don't look at an opportunity to get to do research in something else. And I think that probably leads on to the last thing I'd say, sort of advice to people, is work with other people. You learn a lot from other people. I have done my work on my own research projects and so on, but I get so much more out of working with somebody else who's got a different approach, a different perspective, different set of knowledge. And it keeps you sane working together, discussing the project, etc., writing it up afterwards. So, I would, you know, really advise people to, you know, you've got to like the person, you've got to be on the same wavelength as them to some extent, but it's really enjoyable to do things. Last 20 years, I've been working quite a lot with Peter Rayner in Swansea University, and we're different, but we seem to gel together quite well when we do things. And I'd say finally, I talked to, it's about sort of silos and jealousies and so on, is that we started, Kate Williams and myself, is another colleague, a great colleague now, and was in Aberystwyth University. We started a thing called the Welsh Centre for Crime and Social Justice nearly 10 years ago. And what we did was to get together all criminologists in Wales, and pretty well all of them joined the centre, which was free, so from 8 or 9 universities in Wales. And quite a few practitioners and quite a few policymakers. And we got them together and said, we want to encourage people to work across universities, work with people in policy and practice and so on. And we started running things called trialogues, where we had like a one-day conference where you had equal numbers of policymakers, practitioners and academics giving little 15-minute talks and then discussing that topic as a group. They were usually fairly topical subjects, and they worked really, really well. And also we run and still do, or Kate does mainly now, what you might describe as the Welsh Criminology Conference every year, where we get members of that centre and others together for just 2 days in a lovely place in mid Wales. And we encourage postgraduate students to come to it, give papers, but also academics. And again, that's part of that thing of sort of working together, partnership, sharing, not being jealous of each other's, not hiding away what you're doing because someone else might steal it and so on. You even get it in between faculties or between departments in universities. It's stupid. You should work as much and openly as people as possible and trust them. So I think that would be my last piece of advice. It would be about partnership and sharing and working with other people. So I think that's probably about it, really.
Thank you so much, Mike. It's been great to talk to you about some of the highlights of your career and to get some of your insights into how things have changed and your advice. I've always been inspired by you, and we still, we've written something together really recently. And every time I write with you, I learn some new, ways of thinking about writing. And I just hope that I can write as well as you one day. I'm still working on it. So.
I hope they're going to cut that last bit out.
What, that bit just then?
all this flattery.
Thank you. No, seriously though, Mike, thank you ever so much. You really are a seriously deserved winner of this, long overdue.